Thank you for joining us for this episode of Seward & Kissel's ESG Spotlight Series. I'm Debbie Franzese, a partner in the Investment Management Group and head of the firm's ESG Task Force. For today's discussion, I'm joined by one of the partners in our ERISA group, John Ryan, who's going to tell us a little bit about some of the new proposals that will affect managers who are thinking about an ESG integration or ESG focused fund. But John, before we start getting into the content in relation to ESG, if you could just begin by telling us a little bit about your practice and how you work with investment managers at Seward.
Sure, thanks, Debbie. So I started my career at the Department of Labor at Washington, DC, where I drafted advisory opinions on the fiduciary aspects of ERISA. While at the DOL, I also drafted IB 9401, which was the first of the DOL's sub-advisory guidance on ESG, although back then it was referred to as ETI or economically targeted investments, which was defined as investments selected for the economic benefits they create, apart from the investment return to a plan. At Seward, I spent a lot of time advising managers on the best ways to structure their funds to manage and maximize the amount of benefit plan investors they can accept without their funds becoming too subject to ERISA, and when their benefit plan investor appetite or interest is so significant, how to manage their funds subject to ERISA.
That's great. And then John, just to kind of set the stage for who this conversation is going to be relevant for, this isn't just going to be relevant for managers who manage ERISA funds. It's also going to be relevant for those who manage any ERISA assets. Is that right?
Yeah. When you're managing an ERISA fund, obviously, you're going to be subject to these rules. But again, with ERISA, the fiduciaries who are allocating their plan assets to your fund, even if it's below 25%, are subject to these rules and have to consider how your strategy using ESG is going to affect the plan.
Great, so that's gonna be a large percentage of our managers who this will be relevant for then today. So before we get into the most recent proposal by the Biden administration, John, if you could just set the stage a little bit with some of the general consensus around ESG as it relates to managers who have ERISA capital.
Right. So the statute of ERISA has a requirement that requires that fiduciaries act for the exclusive benefit of the participants and beneficiaries. So that means that an ERISA fiduciary can only act for the interests of the participants and beneficiaries and for the exclusive purpose of providing benefits to those individuals. So there's no wiggle room without a statutory amendment to ERISA that can change that. If you look at the parallel views of some governmental plans, they've added a requirement that consideration for the citizens of a particular state is also a factor, but ERISA doesn't have that. It's purely for the exclusive benefit of the participants and beneficiaries in their retirement. So for 30 years, the DOL has been struggling how to regulate collateral benefits with this exclusive benefit rule.
And so just to clarify, the exclusive benefit rule is stating that an ERISA fiduciary must act for the exclusive purpose of providing the best economic returns.
Right. And, while that core principle of having to act as for the exclusive benefit of the retirees has remained constant, the sort of back and forth of exactly what that means has gone back and forth depending on whether there was a Republican or Democratic administration running the DOL. And basically, most of the back and forth had to do with how the rules, how they affected you, not only in your decision-making, but also in the record-keeping that was required.
And John, how did the Trump administration's approach regarding ESG change as it relates to ERISA?
In 2020, when the Trump administration proposed regulations affecting ESG. So prior to this point in time, it was all sub-advisory guidance. So clearly regulations have the force of law and not just the interpretation of the Department of Labor. And in July, the Trump administration issued these proposals that would really significantly restrict ERISA fiduciaries from considering ESG. In December of 2020, the Trump administration finalized those regulations. However, based on a lot of public comments, they were not nearly as restrictive as the proposals, but they did keep several of the key restrictions and many of the record-keeping requirements that were in the proposal. And just as a little background, it's generally perceived once you have increased record keeping that that has a very chilling effect on a fiduciary's decision-making process, because it just adds a level of work and documentation. So a lot of times the chilling effect isn't so much the statutory requirement as the record keeping requirements that the Department of Labor would require in order to make one of these investments. Under the Trump administration, they also finalized a rule on proxy voting. And this was fairly significant. Again, it was limiting the use of ESG factors in proxy voting, but it also was generally providing safe harbors so that fiduciaries would not breach their fiduciary duty in not voting the securities for the plans they held, which was a significant change from the department's prior guidance, which was that a fiduciary was required to vote unless they could demonstrate why that was not prudent to do so.
And now moving on to the Biden administration, how is their approach to ESG considerations different for ERISA fiduciaries?
With the change of administrations, one of the early activities of the Biden administration was to issue a executive order directing several of the federal agencies, including the DOL, to address climate change. And the goal was to, and this is a direct quote, bolster the resilience of our financial institutions in the face of the climate crisis, rather than exacerbate its causes, and position the United States to lead the global economy to a more prosperous and sustainable future. The executive also specifically required the DOL to revisit the two Trump-era regulations. And finally, in March of 2021, the Department of Labor issued a non-enforcement policy saying that notwithstanding that these regulations were final, the department would not enforce any non-compliance with those regulations. And that sort of brings us up to date.
That's great, John. And I guess just to clarify, so was the issue then under the kind of previous guidance from the Trump administration, did that relate to the exclusive benefit rule in the sense that there was a concern that managers who were incorporating ESG or had maybe a sustainable focused fund, that then they were really subordinating the kind of financial interest of the plan? Is that kind of the general concern that they had? Or focusing on non-investment factors?
Yes, they were always concerned that the considering non-retirement return was a breach of that rule. So by considering climate change, you were promoting, you know, limiting carbon emissions versus providing retirement benefits. And in the preamble, they had taken the position that by promoting a goal, you necessarily were sacrificing return or increasing risk.
Okay, so that's obviously not how some people view ESG considerations, because obviously some people are viewing them as kind of a key component of the risk and return and kind of risk management and maybe overall increase in shareholder value for some companies, which probably brings us to the current proposal. You know, we've talked a little bit about the fact that obviously this affects managers who have accounts that are over 25% and subject to ERISA, but it obviously would be relevant for other clients who are looking to have ERISA assets. So John, if you could just walk us through some of the, you know, main points in the Biden administration's new proposal.
Yeah, sure. I think also sort of following up on that, the proposal from the Trump administration made that clear that they thought incorporating ESG sort of by definition was sacrificing return. A lot of the scaling back in the Trump final rule was they were forced to acknowledge that ESG factors are and can be material to the risk and return analysis. And that sort of flows into the Biden administration, where the, for me, the main change is that consideration has moved even further. And now under the Biden proposal, the ESG factors are presumed to have a risk and return effect, so that you end up with, you know, the same rule, you can't sacrifice risk and return, but the preamble says that risk and return analysis may often require an evaluation of the economic effects of climate change and other environmental, social, and governance factors on a particular investment or investment course of action. So, you know, if you look at the those three regulations, proposal, regulation, final, you go from the Trump proposal, where it was presumed to be a collateral consideration, to the Trump final, where it was acknowledged it could have risk and return characteristics, to the Biden proposal, where it's presumed to have risk and return effect. So I think, you know, as these economically demonstrated effects of ESG on investment returns, you're seeing the regulations move, but the core requirement for the exclusive benefit remaining constant. So the other things that the Biden proposal did was, historically, these rules are all under 404 of ERISA, both the investment decision and the proxy voting decisions. The department historically in the sub-regulatory guidance always addressed them separately. And the Trump administration issued two regulations, one for each. This Biden proposal combines the two into a single regulation. So there, it's sort of a little more streamlined. So this regulation not only would replace the Trump investment regulation, but also replace the Trump proxy voting rule. And the final thing that's, you know, important in the proposal is that it removed the special record keeping rules when you're making an investment based on ESG or considering ESG factors.
That's great, John. And I think that's really helpful for managers to understand what may be different. So this is obviously a deviation from the previous proposals and prior DOL positions. What do you think that this means for managers who are looking to, you know, either have a dedicated ESG fund or have ESG integration within to a fund, but also are looking to accept assets from ERISA plans? I'm assuming that this would make ERISA fiduciaries more comfortable, but what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's going to provide a lot of comfort to both managers who are running an ESG focused fund for an ERISA plan and attracting ERISA money into a fund that has an ESG focus. You know, it creates this presumption and it removes the extra record keeping requirements. So, you know, an allocating ERISA fiduciary isn't going to have to make special documentation over, you know, how ESG is incorporated into the strategy, and the manager, if the ESG fund is over 25%, isn't going to have to do special record keeping to demonstrate how the ESG factors were in fact risk return factors. So I think that's going to be helpful. I think the other really helpful part of this regulation is for our clients who are, you know, attracting international clients. This rule is, you know, much more closely aligned with the EU and the UK regimes regarding sustainability. So you're no longer going to have conflicting ESG regimes that aren't, I mean, not only compatible, but, you know, in conflict. So I think that's going to make managers' lives who are, you know, have both EU and UK and US clients a lot easier without having to try and find a medium between two rules that were basically in conflict.
Yeah, I know that's been important for some of our clients who are marketing in the EU and then also have either ERISA funds or ERISA assets. I know that's been a struggle. So that'll be a welcome change for them, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think the one interesting aspect of the proposal is it's going to be its application to managers who don't take ESG into account. You know, if you have a presumption that ESG is in fact a risk return factor, then an ERISA fiduciary must consider a risk return factor. So that's, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. The proposal did have some very helpful language about, you know, looking at the time horizon of an investment. It commented mostly that, you know, retirement plan assets are long-term investments with long investment horizons, and therefore ESG is more likely to be material to the risk and return over that investment horizon. However, you know, you can take the corollary that wasn't mentioned in the preamble, but if you were, you know, a high-speed trader, you know, clearly a high-speed trader wouldn't necessarily be taking ESG into account because the investment horizon or period for that strategy is so short that you wouldn't necessarily think ESG would be material to either the risk or return. You know, that said, you know, if you're a manager running ERISA money and you're buying beachfront property in Miami without considering climate change and sea level, you could see somebody being held as being imprudent for making that investment. Or, you know, if you're considering buying some kind of oil company without considering the possibility of a carbon tax in certain jurisdictions, again, that might be seen as being imprudent. So it's not quite a mandate to consider ESG. But once you have this presumption, you know, ignoring something that would be a material risk return factor becomes more difficult for people managing ERISA money.
Yeah. So then for managers that have more of a buy and hold strategy where they're looking at to be maybe long-term shareholders of particular companies, this may push them a little further into thinking about ESG integration, at least maybe from a risk management perspective, if you have a ERISA asset.
Or unfortunately, documenting, which, you know, the general documenting your prudent decision-making is, you know, essential for sort of providing, you know, being able to demonstrate you are acting in a prudent fashion. You might consider starting to document what ESG factors you're taking into account, not to justify that it's risk and return, but to justify that you considered it should one of those environmental or social factors, you know, explode on the investment.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. We've talked with managers about thinking about kind of their investment memos or investment committee meeting notes where they may want to be a little bit more specific about the consideration of these factors, whether that's having a separate section for it or having a special part of the meeting that's devoted to that so that you can demonstrate it both for managers who are SEC registered to show the SEC that if you say that you're taking these factors into consideration that you actually are. And now it seems like that would work well and coincide with any maybe documentation that you need under the new DOL regulations as well.
Well, the proposed regulations.
Proposed, yeah.
we always have to wait and see what they're going to come up with. Sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good.
And John, when do you think we'll have proposed or final regulations?
This is a high priority for both the Biden administration and the Department of Labor. So I think they're very focused on it. Their issue is, you know, they have to respond to every public comment directly or in their group. And they tend with these regulations, at least with the Trump era regulation, they got significant public comment. So it really depends on how much public comment they're getting and how busy OMB is. So the other difference between the two regulations is, you know, the department has always said since 1994 that if you have two investments that are, then you can use an ESG or a collateral factor that doesn't affect the risk and return of the investment to, you know, select amongst that. So, you know, historically, you would have two investments in, I think the best example is real estate. One is you're going to provide union jobs for your Taft-Hartley plan, and one is not. They're the same type of investment, filling the same part in the portfolio. The department has said, well, if they're the same, you can choose the investment that's going to generate union jobs because that's a benefit to the Taft-Hartley union plan. So in the Trump administrations, they kept the tiebreaker concept, but they said the investments had to be economically indistinguishable, which is an incredibly high standard. No one knew what that meant, and that you had to document why they were indistinguishable. The proposed rules keeps the tiebreaker concept, but it just says, it sort of goes back to the earlier rules where the two investments have to fill the same role in the portfolio. So it's a much more general standard that's much easier to meet if you wanted to use the tiebreaker.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be easier for managers to do. That other one was obviously a very high standard.
Yeah.
If not, maybe impossible.
So. I would go with impossible standard.
And then I guess, John, just the last topic in relation to proxy voting, I guess if you could talk a little bit about, you know, kind of what the prior proposal was there and then what kind of the current proposal is in relation to proxy voting.
Yeah, so the prior proposal had a lot of sort of following with the SEC rules about selecting proxy services. And the new proposal and the old rule are very, you know, there's a lot of overlap and there wasn't much change in that area. You know, when you are selecting a proxy service, you know, you have to review and understand what they're doing and what their conflicts are. And the DOL and the SEC have coordinated their efforts on those front. The new proposal and the old rule diverge significantly because the Trump era rule not only was discouraging using proxy voting to further ESG, but it was also encouraging fiduciaries and giving a safe harbor for fiduciaries not to vote their plan securities in a whole wide variety of situations. I think in the Trump era proposal, one of the safe harbors that didn't make it into the final was that you could always vote with management and voting management was always going to be prudent, which, you know, seemed a little far out there and it didn't make it into the final rule. So the Biden's administration's rule has gone back to sort of the pre-Trump era rules where it is a fiduciary responsibility to vote proxies unless, you know, there are significant costs, efforts, or restrictions associated with that voting and that you have to vote in the best interest of the participants and beneficiaries. But that section refers back to the section that creates the presumption that ESG factors are in fact economically important, and therefore voting, you know, for ESG proposals would be presumed to be in the economic best interest of the participants and beneficiaries. So, you know, this is going to make it, you know, much easier for plans to, or fiduciaries to vote and adopt proxy voting policies that, you know, incorporate sustainability.
That's great, because that's also been an area of focus by the SEC, where they've looked at, if you say that you're considering ESG factors and things like that, then how does that really impact your business as a whole, including how you're voting proxies or engaging with management on those types of issues. So it looks like there's some further alignment there then.
Yeah. So I think that's going to make fiduciaries' lives a lot easier. But again, you know, going back to the first, you know, if you're a fiduciary and you're adopting a sustainable proxy voting policy from a service provider, you know, you need to understand what that is and how it's working. But I think the SEC would have the same problem of people adopting policies without actually reviewing them and analyzing them to see exactly how they're going to function for particular votes.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. I think the SEC would expect you to do some reasonable amount of due diligence before adopting someone, because ultimately it's still your responsibility, even though you may be adopting some guidelines from someone else. And so you really need to understand what that information is. And hopefully there's enough transparency on the service provider side that you're able to make that decision. I think there's been some recent changes with some service providers giving more transparency. And so hopefully that continues, even if it's provided on a more confidential basis, just so that managers can ensure that any of their due diligence obligations, both from an ERISA and then an SEC perspective, are being done. But that was great, John. I think that's a great overview for managers. And we'll certainly, you know, keep all of our investment management clients posted as to the final regulations, when those come out, if there are any significant changes, both in client memos, and then probably recording another podcast on that as well. So thanks so much for joining us, John.
Well, thank you.